3 years between the end of Esther chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. We're told that Xerxes gave his banquet in the third year of his reign, and we read that Esther was taken to him in the seventh year of his reign, having first completed 12 months of beauty treatments since the king's order. In between this time, history records tell us that King Xerxes made an ambitious but disastrous attempt to conquer Greece. Now remember that King Xerxes was an incredibly powerful and proud king. He was known to be the most powerful man on earth at the beginning of his reign. Archaeologists excavating at Susa have found inscriptions from that time in which King Xerxes has referred to himself as the great king, the king of kings, the king of the lands occupied by many races, the king of this great earth. What a proud man. But now, humiliated by his defeat from Greece, I think we can assume it's a more subdued and discontent man that we read of as we start Esther chapter 2. Perhaps during his attack on Greece, Xerxes' mind was too full of the battle and his assumed victory to perhaps consider the consequences of Vashti's banishment. But now, returning to Susa, defeated, humiliated, battle-weary, and no longer drunk, presumably, there is some regret, maybe, that he no longer has the companionship and comfort of a wife. And I wonder if there's a sense of loneliness, too. As would have been the case with the other monarchs of the time, it's very likely that King Xerxes had a whole harem full of women, and certainly he had the power to command any woman in the kingdom to appear before him whenever he wanted. So it seems that in following the advice of his attendants, what he's looking for is not just a one-night stand or a casual relationship, but a replacement queen, a wife who'd be a long-term companion and who'd live by his side and share his life and care for him. Esther 2, verse 2. The king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it, unsurprisingly. Well, not unlike us, the Persians were obsessed with physical beauty. Even their noble men had makeup artists. So this plan would be a way of ensuring that the king's next wife would be the most beautiful woman in Persia. We're told in verse 12 that this woman's beauty would be enhanced with preparations and makeup for a whole year. One commentary writer says that those words in verse 12 mean to rub, to polish, to purify and adorn with all kinds of precious ointments. So this seems like a good opportunity for us to ask ourselves, are we also obsessed with our physical beauty? Most of us probably, hopefully, don't have the means or opportunity to pamper ourselves completely and enhance ourselves for 12 months. But what about our attitudes to beauty? Let me ask you, honestly, how often do you think about your appearance? Are you content with the body shape that God has given you? What drives you to keep fit if you do? Is it a desire to look after the body that God's given you so that you'll be more equipped to serve him effectively? Or is it a desire to glorify yourself by striving for the perfect figure that will impress other women and attract male attention? Most of us, I think, have probably wished that we were more beautiful at times, but Esther's exceptional beauty was given to her by God, not for her glory, but to fulfil his purposes for his people. Do you spend more money on clothes, face creams, makeup and gym membership than you give to God's work? Do you spend more time on exercise and shopping than you do in prayer and Bible study? When you get ready to meet other Christians at church or home groups, do you spend all your preparation time on your physical appearance, or are you preparing your heart and praying that God will equip you to refresh and encourage and minister to those that you'll be meeting with? It's easy, isn't it, to be critical of our society, which places a huge emphasis on the physical and temporary attributes of beauty, without realising that we actually fit into that society pretty well. I wonder whether you've intentionally adopted a different standard for attractiveness, or are your standards those imposed on you by the world? We're actually in a similar situation to Esther. We are to be spending our time making ourselves beautiful for a king, for our King Jesus, who will one day meet face to face as we enter his presence. I wonder what sort of beauty treatments you're giving yourself each day as you prepare for the moment you enter his throne room. Well, let's move on. And we're going to look now at a portrait of godly beauty. And the first aspect of godly beauty that we're going to look at is in Mordecai, loving with grace. So verses 5 to 7 of Esther chapter 2 provide us with a short break from the palace scene and transfer our attention to the home of a normal man named Mordecai. We're told that Mordecai was a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin and that he was living in Susa. It appears that Mordecai's great-grandfather was one of the Jews who'd been taken into exile by Nebuchadnezzar. And although some of the Jews had since returned to Jerusalem, Mordecai was still living in Persia, actually in the citadel of Susa, close to the king's palace. We're also told that Mordecai is raising his orphaned cousin, Hadassah, also known by her Persian name Esther, which means star. Verse 7 tells us that Mordecai had taken his cousin Esther as his own daughter when her father and mother died. That gives us a little bit of insight into his character, doesn't it? That fact alone, I think, suggests a principled man of integrity and compassion. And as we work through the story, we'll see more of Mordecai's character and how his godly influence upon Esther impacts events. I think verse 11 gives a lovely picture of a concerned and protective guardian as we read that every day Mordecai walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. This isn't a man adopting his younger cousin out of a begrudging sense of duty, eager to be shot of the responsibility as soon as he can. No, I think Mordecai shows a continuing commitment to Esther and a concern for her well-being even after she leaves his home for the palace. We don't usually refer to men when we talk about beauty, but Mordecai's character and behaviour towards his cousin is beautiful because it reflects God's character. We're also introduced in these three verses to Esther. We've just noticed that she was an orphan. Her mother and father were dead, and she was being raised by her older cousin Mordecai. It's easy to gloss over that point, isn't it, when we read the biblical narrative. But here's a girl who'd lost both her mum and her dad. That's a heartbreaking tragedy, isn't it? However well loved and cared for she was by Mordecai, and however much she may have loved him, Esther had experienced the devastating and crushing pain of losing not just one, but both of her parents at a young age. She'd experienced brokenness, and yet we're going to see how God was working so that years later, Esther would be instrumental in saving his people, the Jews. The only other detail we read about Esther at this point is that she was very beautiful. The NIV describes her as being lovely in form and features. We would say she had a beautiful face and a stunning figure. She was a very beautiful but nonetheless lowly Jew and had no connection with the most powerful man in the Persian Empire, King Xerxes. But God, in his sovereignty, was weaving these two unrelated lives together. Secondly, we're going to see godly beauty in Esther, lifting up grace. Excuse me. It's thought that there could have been as many as 400 women involved in this quest to find the next king, queen. And yet we read that Esther was the one who caught the attention of Hegai, the eunuch in charge of the women, and that would include all of the women in the palace harem. In verse 9, we read that Esther pleased him and won his favour. Immediately, he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. The literal translation of verse 9 in the original language says, "She lifted up grace before his face." This is what made her stand out from among the 400 most beautiful young women in the kingdom. She lifted up grace. What a lovely expression. Wouldn't you like to be known as the woman who lifts up grace before others? It's Esther's inner beauty that draw attention to her. And if we want to lift up grace before others, there are some lessons that we can learn from Esther's behaviour in the king's palace. We're told in verse 8 that Esther was taken to the king's palace. Now, the phrase "was taken" can mean taken by force, and it is used in that context in other parts of the Old Testament. Now, we don't know for sure whether Esther was literally taken by force, but I think we can assume some reluctance on her part to be taken with this group of women to the palace, knowing that regardless of whether she was chosen to become queen, there was little chance of her returning home once she'd entered the harem. She was a young Jewess, protected and cared for by a guardian she loved and respected, Mordecai. Would she want to leave her home and the prospect of a Jewish marriage for a life in a harem where she'd be used for dutiful sex for as long as she was considered beautiful and then discarded? Would she really choose to enter an environment undoubtedly filled with rivalry, cattiness, jealousy and envy, where only the shape of her body and the beauty of her face would be of concern? On top of that, the fact that Mordecai tells her to keep her nationality a secret suggests potential danger for her as a Jew in the palace environment. Now, it's unlikely that Esther would have been voluntarily choosing this place for herself. I think it more likely that she would have been terrified as she was taken to the palace. I wonder if you've ever been taken to a place that you would never have chosen for yourself. I don't necessarily mean a physical place, though some of you here may have had to move home, city, even country, against your will. But maybe you found yourself in a situation in life that you would never have chosen, that is so far removed from your dreams. Maybe you're there right now, struggling with ill health or financial ruin, fighting with a family member or close friend, rejected by a husband, child or parents, working in an ungodly or antagonistic environment, feeling forsaken by a friend or maybe even by God himself. And maybe you're struggling to see God's purpose in your situation, how it can possibly be for your good and for God's glory. Or notice how Esther, God's star, shines brightly in a dark situation as she lifts up grace and lets see the hope that we can find in her story. There are aspects of Esther's inner beauty that stand out in this chapter and that we can challenge ourselves to cultivate in our lives as Christian women. So the first thing I notice about Esther is that she had strength and dignity. We've already acknowledged that it would have been a frightening thing for her, especially as a young Jewess, to enter the king's harem. But when we read about her time there, we don't get the impression of a vulnerable girl cowering in the corner. Equally, we don't read of her parading herself arrogantly in front of the rest of the harem or boasting about her natural beauty. She must have had a quiet confidence about her, though, or she wouldn't have been noticed by Haggai and wouldn't have stood out to him as a potential queen for King Xerxes. I'm reminded of the verse in Isaiah 30, "In quietness and trust is your strength." Israel didn't live out that promise and consequently ended up in captivity. But it seems that in the intimidating and godless palace of proud King Xerxes, Esther displayed that quiet trust in her God, and this was her strength. So let me ask, is quietness and trust in a faithful God your strength? In your frightening or seemingly hopeless situation, are you despairing and running scared? Or do you have a quiet, confident trust in the God who's always working, even when he seems to be silent? Well, it's easy to forget that the replacement queen was not judged by King Xerxes on her looks alone. We're told that when a young woman was summoned, she was to spend the night with the king, and it's implied that she was to please him sexually as well as with her beauty. That's shocking to us, isn't it, in 21st century. Part of Esther's preparation was to teach her, in effect, how to successfully seduce King Xerxes. And yet, when we read the narrative, we don't get the impression of any loss of dignity on Esther's part. She was a relatively young girl, probably late teens, early 20s. She was taken to the harem, most likely against her will, and she had little choice but to do as she was instructed. I think today we would maybe call that a form of sexual abuse, wouldn't we? And yet, I believe that Esther did not lose her dignity. It is possible for a godly woman to maintain her dignity, even in the most undignified of situations. It is possible to lift up grace, even in the most humiliating and degrading of circumstances. And perhaps that's an encouragement to someone here. Well, the second thing I want us to notice is that Esther displayed self-control and modesty. Esther was given special treatment by Haggai when she entered the harem. She was given her own maids, 7 of them, and the best living quarters, along with special food, and her beauty treatments were started immediately, so she would have been one of the first women to be ready to meet the king. We're told that when each of the young women was to be presented to the king at least a year later, anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. That's verse 13. But Esther asked for nothing other than what Haggai suggested. That shows great restraint and self-control, doesn't it? I wonder if that was true for any other than what was suggested. Remember, the point of the contest was to please the king and gain his favour in order to be crowned the next queen. I imagine most women would have taken advantage of every possible extravagance offered to them in order to make themselves as appealing as possible to King Xerxes and to win his favour. So Esther displays a modest restraint that's endearing and again suggests her trust in God for her future and no particular ambition to be crowned a queen. Maybe God has blessed you with wealth. How do you use it? Do you show modest restraint and self-control? Or do you spend what you want when you want to satisfy your own desires? Maybe God has blessed you with great talents. How do you use them? Are you modest, showing self-control and humility? Or do you push yourself forward and parade your gift at every opportunity? Maybe you've been blessed with great external beauty. Are you modest, seeking not to draw unnecessary attention to yourselves, and especially seeking to honour your brothers in Christ by not becoming an unhelpful distraction to them? I find Esther's modesty and self-control very endearing. I wonder if others see that same quality in our lives. Well, thirdly, Esther was humble and teachable. Once in the harem, it would have been very easy for Esther to have been swept along with the frenzied competition to be crowned the next queen, to become so busy rushing from one pampering session to the next with relaxing indulgences in between that her ties with Mordecai could have become severed. It's a mark of her humility, respect, and teachable spirit that Esther continued to follow Mordecai's advice even after leaving his home. We read that she did not reveal her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Having gained Haggai's favour, Esther could easily have become complacent about following this advice. She could have thought that her position in the harem was secure because of her beauty and winsomeness. But she followed Mordecai's instructions. Even after she'd been made queen, Esther followed this instruction. And verse 20 tells us that she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. In other words, she didn't become proud and she was still willing to listen and learn. Well, as women today, we have many opportunities that women in the past have not had. We can be very well educated and allow our intelligence to shine in a way that was not common perhaps a century ago. We can embrace any career we want and assume prestigious titles and roles in our communities. Some of us are given opportunities to study and teach the Bible in a way that would not be common maybe even 50 years ago. These are great privileges, but they're also opportunities for pride and a lack of humility to develop. So let me ask you, are you still teachable? Do you welcome feedback and input from friends, husbands, parents, children, pastors, church leaders? Or do you feel above that now? Do you think that because you're so well taught and experienced in Bible handling that you've got nothing to learn from the new Christian in your home group or the student who's yet to know what life's really all about? Let me encourage you, as I encourage myself, to follow Esther's example and retain a humble, teachable spirit. That's a mark of grace, isn't it? Let me read a couple of verses from Proverbs chapter 13. Firstly, verse 10, pride leads to arguments. Those who take advice are wise. And verse 14, the advice of the wise is like a life-giving fountain. Those who accept it avoid the snares of death. So being practical for a moment, can I ask you, who is your accountability partner? Who asks you the tough questions about your behaviour, your walk with the Lord, your spiritual growth? Who challenges you when you make decisions that might prove to be unwise? Who do you trust to love you enough to tell you the truth and encourage you to persevere in modelling grace? If you haven't got a friend like that, why not ask God to point you towards someone you can be accountable to, another woman who will keep you humble and teachable? When I was preparing this a while ago, my heart was filled with praise to God for giving me friends like that, particularly in Kath and in Beth. And I've got to tell you, there are some days where my phone has pinged to announce a text from Beth and my heart has sunk. Sorry, my friend. But perhaps I've shared with her the week before that I'm struggling to be disciplined in prayer or to show love to someone in our church who I find difficult. And I know that's Beth telling me she's been praying for me. How am I doing? Am I being disciplined? Am I getting on with it? Is God helping me in this situation? And that's not always what I want to hear, but it's what I need to hear. And I'm so grateful to God for a friend, for friends who love me enough to care more about what's best for my spiritual growth than what I think of them. So thank you, friend. Well, we read in verse 9 that Esther pleased Hegai and won his favour. And then we read in verse 15 that she won the favour of everyone who saw her. In verse 17 we read, the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favour and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Esther's external beauty would obviously have been enhanced by the 12 months of beauty treatments, and I'm sure there would have been improvements to her etiquette and poise and articulation as well. I'm sure that would have comprised part of the preparation process. But all of the women in the harem would have benefited from those treatments, and so all would have appeared more beautiful than they were 12 months before. Why does Esther especially stand out? I'm sure her inner beauty, her grace, is what won her the favour of everyone who saw her. Everyone implies even maybe the women in the harem who were competing against her for the king's attention. So how can we develop these characteristics of grace that will be evident to everyone who sees us? If you love the Lord passionately, I know that you will want to shine grace like Esther did. But doesn't it just seem too hard sometimes? Isn't it too improbable to have all these admirable qualities? Doesn't her character seem so different to ours, to normal women? Well, God doesn't have unrealistic expectations for us. He doesn't provide in his word a beautiful example of grace so that we feel frustrated by our own weaknesses and sense of inadequacy. He's placed us in our individual circumstances with our individual pressures and challenges, but he's also given us his power and his spirit so that we can become his star of grace in them. So why not ask God to develop a grace-filled character within you? Why not ask him to free you from the world's desires and priorities and give you a desire for spiritual life and inner beauty? If you're not yet a Christian, why not pray and ask God that he'll give you an understanding of his love for you and a desire to love him and live for him? If you are a Christian, but you know you lack credibility, ask God to make you discontent with your current priorities and habits, and to fill you with a passion to radiate Jesus in every area of your life, to be concerned about what's going on in your heart rather than the external and superficial. If you're overwhelmed by your circumstances and the place that you find yourself in, ask God to fill you with a quiet trust in his sovereignty and an unswerving, dedicated pursuit of his will for you. Let's trust God to control the circumstances around us and to develop beauty, dignity, and grace that will draw attention to him. Don't use your circumstances as an excuse not to be the woman you want to be, the woman you were created to be. Don't wait until your circumstances change before you allow God to shine his grace through you. Trust him that he can transform us in our circumstances, however undignified, humiliating, frightening they may be, so that his grace and power is lifted up in front of everyone who sees us. Well, lastly, in both Esther and Mordecai, we see our third attribute of godly beauty, living out grace. We noticed earlier in our introduction to Mordecai that he continued to look out for Esther while she was in the harem. This care and devotion did not stop even after she was crowned queen. It seems from verse 19 that after Esther's coronation, Mordecai secured himself a job as a palace official at the king's gate so that he could be near Esther each day. And again, we see the quiet but always active hand of God at work in ensuring that Mordecai should be in just the right place at just the right time, ready to uncover a conspiracy against the king and, unbeknown to him, further put in place events that will be key in the saving of God's people, the Jews. Verses 21 to 23 of Esther 2 record such a tiny vignette of Persian history, they almost seem insignificant in the light of everything else that's going on. The story almost seems misplaced in this chapter of the book, but again we'll see that God is working in the day-to-day insignificancies of palace life, silently weaving together people and events for his purposes. The second gathering of the virgins suggests that the king's officials continued to gather beautiful girls for the harem. Now, this shouldn't surprise us. From everything we know of King Xerxes, it's unlikely that he'd suddenly embrace a restrained life of monogamy just because he's found his next queen in Esther, releasing hundreds of beautiful women from his court. We saw how quickly he dismissed his previous queen Vashti because of her failure to comply with his irrational wishes. And we've seen his propensity for hedonistic living. Why would that stop now, just because he'd found his next queen? In fact, the detail later on in Esther chapter 4, verse 11, that Esther had not been called into the king's presence for 30 days strongly supports this assumption. It seems that Xerxes is still in party mode, banqueting and holidaying with extravagance. And at that time of banqueting and rejoicing, we come across Mordecai in a new position of honour and authority. In the east, the king's gate was the equivalent of our law courts, a place where important business was carried out. It's not unlikely that Esther used her influence as the new queen to secure that position for her cousin. And Mordecai is now in place to uncover an assassination plot against Xerxes and report it to Esther so that she can warn the king. It's interesting that we're not told why Bigthana and Teresh became angry with the king. It could have been because they were Vashti fans and didn't want to see her replaced. It could be because he chose to marry Esther, an outsider of the court, rather than one of the daughters of the seven noble families of the kingdom, as was more customary. It might be over something really silly, like they didn't get nice enough gifts or important enough seats at the banquet. The fact that we're not told suggests that it's not something of great significance. But anger's like that, isn't it? It can start over something really small and then grow into hatred and even a desire to harm or kill. Now, Mordecai could have chosen to ignore the conspiracy to assassinate the king. King Xerxes was not a nice man. He was a self-serving, egotistical hothead. Mordecai's adopted daughter was living in the palace as his queen, still hiding her nationality, which suggests she was still in potential danger if that was made public. Mordecai could have wondered if he and Esther would have been safer and better off with King Xerxes out of the way. He could have thought, I'll just keep quiet and see what happens. It might work out for the best. But Mordecai didn't do that. He made the decision to warn the king through Esther. He showed grace to a graceless king when he had the opportunity. It's a lovely reminder of Esther's humility and modesty that she gave credit for uncovering the plot to Mordecai. She could have taken the credit for herself, further securing her favour with the king and benefiting herself, but she credits Mordecai, and his name was recorded in the official historical chronicles as the one who saved the king's life. And although it seems that there was no immediate reward or benefit to Mordecai for this loyalty, we'll see that 4 years later, God would make use of it in a special way. We're going to study chapter 3 later after coffee, but the first verse tells us that after these events, King Xerxes honoured Haman the Agagite. Mordecai is the one who saved the king's life. Why isn't he being honoured? We read in verse 3 of chapter 3, Mordecai is still at the king's gate. He hasn't had a promotion. Life's like that, isn't it? Even the Christian life. Perhaps you feel you work hard, you have great ideas, you do many sacrificial acts of kindness or service, and yet you're unnoticed, unrewarded, unappreciated. while others are thanked or publicly praised or given opportunities that perhaps you'd like for yourself. Hebrews 6:10 says, God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you have shown him as you have helped his people and continue to help them. When no one else notices what we do, God notices. When no one else remembers us, God remembers. When no one else rewards, God prepares an eternal reward for us. So let me encourage you, keep doing the right thing. Keep showing grace. Keep serving wholeheartedly. Remember that God sees and remembers and is just in his rewards. Be spurred on by the models of grace that we see in this chapter of the book of Esther, and be encouraged that God, although silent at times, is always working his purposes out.